Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. It is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we all, if you have any faith, if you have faith in a creator, then we appeal to you to appeal to heaven. And so we'll just say, as we always do, learn, keep learning, and keep praying and getting more specific and acting upon the specificities that we are seeking help with. When we get into the movement, everything has to be tied. So find it interesting, as we basically were taking the position in 2018, 2017, about full compliance with the Constitution, there was a shift by some conservative organizations. It's the oath. But they never connected the dots. And what's really important is that you connect the dots. And the process of connecting the dots, which they don't even touch, I have no idea why some of these, you know, self-aggrandizing conservative organizations go out there and say, it's the oath, when they don't connect the dots to petitioning, assembling, and petitioning government for the redress of grievances, and using Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, holding them accountable to that oath. When they have violated that oath, holding them accountable is to remove them. And I see this all the time. I see this in social media. I hear idiots on the radio, your favorite conservative entertainers, idiots, not understanding this. Don't worry about the legal process now. Get them out of office. Section 3 gives the president the full power to execute that law. The Constitution, Article 2, gives the president the full ability to go in and remove a person from their position by laying out the charge how they violated their oath in failing to support the Constitution. Oh, how are they failing to support the Constitution regarding the invasion? By stopping the repelling of invaders, because the Constitution clearly requires them be repelled, removed from this nation. Constitution compliance. This is why literacy on the Constitution, or the lack thereof, is killing us. So the focus of the show, you know, very few people don't know what they don't know, right? And so, I mean, nobody has that clairvoyance. Nobody has that depth of, oh, I need to learn these things, because they just don't understand them. And it is painfully obvious that there are people that do, the majority of people of the United States, the majority of the good patriots and citizens, do not know how illiterate they are on the Constitution. They've been spoon-fed, and this is why all the conservatives are seeking their pound of flesh and demanding justice be served in the courts. That is the last place we need to go. We got to get these guys out of office, because as long as they are at the grasp of power, they're going to continually upset us and pervert our ways. Now, this is why demanding full compliance of the Constitution has to be centered, not a part of the Constitution, not just, you know, this apportionment, not just the 17th Amendment taking back the suffrage of the Senate. That's a one-trick pony. It all has to go to and lend to this concept of holding every public servant fully accountable to every aspect of the Constitution. Madison was clear in his report, as well as in the Virginia resolutions of 1798. State legislators, county legislators, need to oppose every infraction of that Constitution. Who cares about the other stuff? Who cares? Because bottom line, if they decide to compromise and give you health care, that is an infraction of the Constitution. The federal government has no enumerated power to do that. And therefore, anybody and everybody that was a part of that bill, which means that bottom line, we're going to go through a lot of public service at the federal level, and a lot of, almost every blue state is going to be fully swept clean. And what's going to happen when they put the next progressives in there? They will be equally swept out as fast as they can lift a finger to try to defy the Constitution. Folks, have faith in the Constitution. Where is this nation's faith in its founding documents? This just, it's very troubling. So bottom line, we need to start understanding what you don't know, and it's all here in the Constitution. One of the key things that I'm laying out right now, we're going through the Enabling Acts. We already read, or I already read, the Enabling Act of Vermont, and I showed you how clean and simple it was brought into the Union. I'm going through the Utah Enabling Act, which was at the very end of the 19th century when they joined the Union. Now, what I'm going to do, because I think this is paramount, is I'm going to go through the admission of the state of Louisiana before I finish the state of Utah. And I'll explain why, but I got one more obligatory. If you want to see the 2028 election going in a different direction than the Uniparty and having the next globalist sit at the helm of this nation and guide us into the arms of the globalists, we need to start demanding the Electoral College be restored, that we the people choose our electors and allow the electors to be selected, or to select the president and the vice president. We have to dismantle this party primary crap. And as a matter of fact, if everybody, you know, I don't know why we're so concerned about Republican and Democrat, the factions of the parties, when we should be concerned about compliance of the Constitution. It all comes back down to that. Because if you actually start holding people accountable, those people, like in Montana, the Nasty Nine, they were violating their oath of the Constitution by supporting agendas and things that were literally violations of the U.S. Constitution. Get rid of them. We just need to start moving forward in understanding and behaving. And if a state legislature is afraid, if the people, the good people, are afraid that they don't know the Constitution, then create your Constitutional Compliance Committee and let them be your guide and let them guide you. Because as long as you're doing everything you can to do the right thing, then the people can't hold you, you know, can't be upset and try to hold you accountable. We're all learning. But to do nothing is reprehensible. And with that, let's dive into the Louisiana Enabling Act. Now, Louisiana joined the Union, and as a matter of fact, let me frame this so that this is crystal clear. Why is Louisiana so important? Because Louisiana was a foreign state. Those who were in Louisiana were French and Spanish. Even though we obtained it from France, Spain was the one that actually kind of settled in there, and they kind of built it up and then kind of left it to France. So when Louisiana joined the Union in 1812, folks, let's look, because we're already showing you how the federal government is telling the state of Utah that there are certain lands that they can't have, that the federal government has taken possession of these lands, and I believe, there's no doubt in my mind that at this point in time, because the federal government had usurped this constitutional, or this concept of mineral rights, owning the soil. In other words, where in the Constitution did we delegate to the federal government the ability to own all of our resources? As a matter of fact, that was repugnant to the framers. The framers did not want to see the federal government become the rich body. As a matter of fact, when they were framing the Constitution and they were inserting this concept of assembling and petitioning government for the redress of grievances, they wanted to make sure that the government would never be able to financially, they would just be required to get things right. They weren't to be rich, so that the redress of grievances literally meant that they got things right. They wanted to make sure that the federal government never became a rich bastion of wealth. that the states were to possess the wealth and to grow and to actually have their own economies. There's no enumeration in the Constitution for the federal government to maintain and manage the economies. They're only to manage the value of our currency by keeping from printing it or creating coins without a real cause, maintaining a solidity in the value of that currency. The only reason why we have had depressions and financial woes is because the federal government, with its treasury and the way it was manipulating the currency with speculations on silver coins, because it happened under Ulysses S. Grant. It's happened. And it should never have happened. There, it was their job to maintain a level value of the currency. And had they had these sound policies, they would have been able to do that. As a matter of fact, financially, the nation collapsed in the early 1800s. That national bank went bankrupt. And that actually ruined the financial state of John Adams. He was heavily vested in that. And so I guess he learned. And as a matter of fact, the whole nation should have learned that the federal government shouldn't be involved in making products of money. In other words, that bank was actually creating bonds and all these other things in playing this financial game when they shouldn't have been doing it. They should have only been maintaining the value of the currency. So when Louisiana joined the Union, they joined the Union in 1812. So this is a few years after Vermont and a century before Utah. Now, the Constitution has never been changed. And we've gone through Article 4, Section 3 a few times already. The very first paragraph identifies how the configuration of states could be created. They can't be created out of other states without the state legislature's approval. If it's a territory, then it just comes straight into the Union as an equal member. But if it is a group of states forming a new state, or a state wanting to split or what have you, then the state legislatures of those affected states have to approve the creation of that state. That's the first paragraph. The second paragraph is perfunctory. These are the basic administrative responsibilities that the federal government has to ensure the progress of taking a territory and it getting it admitted as a full, equal-footed party to the compact. In other words, when it joins the union one-to-one with the states. In other words, one-to-many. It has every equal footing and every full equal sovereignty in every state. And then when all of these Western states started joining the union with disabilities, all of the Eastern states, oh, that's okay. We don't care. It's not affecting us. Folks, this is how groups and organizations get destroyed, because as long as certain people say, well, as long as it doesn't hurt me, and that's exactly how things actually progress, because it doesn't hurt you. They just go after the new guys. They go after these new parties and so forth. And down the road, it ends up coming back to everybody, and they basically attack everybody. They've been waging warfare tactics for the last half century, at least, if not longer. Now, this is the Louisiana Act, Enabling Act, an act for the admission of the state of Louisiana into the Union and to extend the laws of the United States to the said state. Whereas, again, this is a foreign state joining the Union. There may be American citizens there, but primarily this is a foreign state. It was configured with parishes, not counties. Whereas the representatives of the people of all that part of the territory or country ceded under the name of Louisiana, ceded, C-E-D-E-D, name of Louisiana by the treaty made in Paris on the 13th day of April, 1803, between the United States and France, contained within the following limits, that is to say, beginning at the mouth of the River Sabine, thence by a line to be drawn along the middle of the said river, including all islands, to the 32nd degree of latitude, thence due north to the northernmost part. So they're really going through, what they're going through right here, folks, is they're going through the boundaries of Louisiana that it'll be known for moving forward. This is the border of Louisiana. So for the most part, I have no idea who's bothering us, but for the most part, I'm just going to leave it there with this very first section, this very first part, that they are going to identify these leagues and directions and coordinates and so forth. And at the very end of this, it says, an act to enable the people of the territory of Orleans to form a constitution and state government, and for the admission of the said state into the Union on equal footing with the original states and for other purposes, and the said constitution having been transmitted to Congress and by them being hereby approved, therefore, be it enacted that the state, that the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States in America in Congress assembled, that the said state shall be one and is hereby declared to be one of the United States of America and admitted into the Union on equal footing with the original states in all respects whatever by the name and title of the state of Louisiana, provided that it shall take as a condition upon which the said state is incorporated in the Union that the river Mississippi and the navigational rivers and waters leading into the same and into the Gulf of Mexico shall be common highways and forever free, as well as the inhabitants of the said state, as to the inhabitants of other states and the territories of the United States, without any tax, duty, impost, or toll, therefore imposed by the said state, and the above condition, and also all other conditions and terms contained in the third section of the Act, the title whereof is herein before recited, shall be deemed and taken fundamental conditions and terms upon the said state as incorporated in the Unions. Now, what they just did was they basically laid out, because the federal government has the authority to control main waterways as navigational control. In other words, making sure that one state can't, especially a river that splits states like the Columbia with Washington and Oregon. If it is a navigational river that can bring in commerce, the Potomac, the Mississippi, many of the rivers that were on the West Coast, or I mean the East Coast, the Hudson, or any river that was actually going to and through other states. No state could actually levy an impost on all commerce going through that state, whether it was going to another state or not. So this was basically making sure that no state could take a financial advantage of commerce flowing into another state. This is how the states and how the federal government had the responsibility of regulating commerce among the states so no state could take advantage of other states. The federal government has no constitutional authority to regulate commerce within the state. Now, what surprises me is that this show is not considered the number one show of legislators in the United States, because if they wanted to understand what they could do and how to do their job, this would be the show that would help them. This would actually be the show, because we read these documents and we say, prove us wrong. So, forgive the arrogance, but Section 2, and it be further enacted that until the next general census and apportionment of the representatives, the said state shall be entitled to one representative in the House of Representatives of the United States, and that all laws of the United States not locally inapplicable shall be extended to the said state and shall have the same force and effect within the same as elsewhere within the United States. So basically, you're joining the Union and all the laws that they have created in pursuance to the Constitution are applicable to you. And you get one representative until the next census, which would be in 1820. So the third act, and it be further enacted that the said state, together with the residue of that portion of the country which is comprehended within the territory of Orleans, as constituted by the act entitled, quote, an act erecting Louisiana into two territories and providing for the temporary government thereof shall be one district and called the Louisiana District. So what they're doing here, and I believe this is where they start setting up the legal structure of the courts, that there'll be a judge and a district judge and so forth. And so let me keep going here. Provided the temporary government thereof shall be one district and called Louisiana District, and there shall be established in the said district a district court to consist of one judge who shall reside therein and be called the district judge. And there shall be annually four stated sessions of the said court held at the city of Orleans, the first to commence on the third Monday in July next, and three other sessions progressively on the third day of every third calendar month thereafter. The said judge shall in all things have and exercise the same jurisdiction and powers which by the act of the title whereof is in this section recited were given to the district judge to the territory of Orleans, and he shall be allowed an annual compensation of $3,000 to be paid quarterly at the treasury of the United States. So this is a federal judge. The said judge shall appoint a clerk of the said court who shall reside and keep records of the court in the city of Orleans and shall receive for the services performed by him the same fees heretofore allowed to the clerk of the Orleans territory. Now, this is kind of interesting, this next one. Section 4. And it be enacted that there should be appointed in the said district a person learned in the law to act as an attorney for the United States. Because, see, at this point, they hadn't done this yet. At this point, this is where they started realizing that the judge cannot sit there and act as an attorney. He has to be unbiased. And so how was the United States going to have its interest represented in these federal courts if they didn't have a federal attorney? So they started creating federal attorneys for all of these districts to manage the case and pursue the interests of the United States, or to ensure that the differences between states was managed by, a separate or an uninterested or a non-involved party, an unbiased party. And so this is why the federal government created this federal attorney. To be paid $600 annually as a full compensation for all extra services, there shall be appointed a marshal for the said district who shall perform the same duties, be subject to the same regulations and penalties, and entitled to the same fees to which marshals in other districts are entitled for similar services, and shall moreover be paid $200 annually as compensation for all extra services. Section 5. And it be further enacted that nothing in this act shall be construed to repeal the fourth section of an act entitled, quote, an act for laying and collecting duties on imports and tonnages within the territory ceded to the United States by the treaty of the 13th of April, 1803. So in other words, this is language right here to make sure that Louisiana does not violate those arbitrated agreements between France and Spain in putting taxes or imposts upon trade coming into Louisiana. Remember, we kind of went through that already when we went through the 1803 Louisiana Territory Act. And so between the United States and the French Republic and for other purposes, and that the collection district shall be remain as thereby established. And 6, and to be further enacted that this act shall commence and be in force from and after the 13th day of April, 1812. And that is it. And approved April 8th, 1812. This didn't go to the president. The president didn't approve this. The president had no involvement in this, nor did the Supreme Court. This was done. Congress had the responsibility of admitting states into the Union. Their hands were tied, that every state must join the Union in full equal footing, but they had a responsibility because of the district courts, the way the federal court system was broken up, that when new states started joining, they would be adjoined either to this district or another district, or they would create a new district. This is why we have, what, the 9 district courts, so that the, you know, the areas, the states around that would have a court that they would be able to go to hear those constitutional cases that the federal government actually had jurisdiction over. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, folks, so clearly, this foreign nation, foreign state, being agreed to or transferred via treaty to the United States, and after, 9 years, right, from 1803 to 1812, it had been prepared via the, you know, the process of admitting states into the Union. So it had been prepared to become a state in the Union properly by Congress. Therefore, when Congress admitted it into the Union, they made sure that it was placed into the Union in full compliance to the Constitution. Now, Madison was president at this point in time. And the many people that were involved in Congress at this point in time were actually those people who were involved in the 13th Amendment and its ratification, which is the nobility clause. The 13th Amendment that most of you don't know about. We go through this every year when we go through the Constitution. This is the 13th Amendment that has been unconstitutionally expunged from the Constitution by the Bar Association, the judges, lawyers, and all the other nefarious people that helped transition our legal system into this nightmare that it is today. Which is one of the reasons why justice is almost impossible to get. It is built. Justice is made of unattainium because it's unattainable. Anyway, as we look at the Utah Enabling Act, we've already seen how they took chunks of land and the federal government claimed it as theirs, with no amendment to the Constitution granting them this, nor any amendment to the Constitution delegating the authority for the United States to control and possess all mineral rights. You want them, you got to buy them from them. And or you can lease them, and that way the federal government makes money. And it all, so how is it that this federal government became a vessel of profit? Because Britain wanted it that way. Britain needed it that way because Britain had almost gone fully bankrupt due to its losing of the United States from fighting 2 revolutionary wars and then being stiffed by the Civil War with the 14th Amendment saying that they will not get a red penny from any state in this union. All states who took out loans to fight the insurrection, if they were in the Union, they were not obligated to that that contract. Now, going into, because we kind of left off with Section 6 of the Utah Enabling Act, I'm just going to try to go through these things to show you, because we've already shown you a few things that they have asserted in this Enabling Act that were literally violations of the Constitution. And when we look at how many more things are still laying out to be claimed or to be asserted must be done because the federal government is forcing the states to do this, this just goes to show how far out of the bounds the federal government had gotten at the end of the 18th or 19th century, 1800s or the end of the 19th century. Because again, this was actually being promulgated in 1890-something, right? Let me go back up to the date on this. And we can actually see this was 1894. Okay, so Section 7 of the Utah Enabling Act, that upon the admission of said state into the Union in accordance with the provisions of this Act, 100 sections of 100 sections, there's all these sections of land, 100 sections of the unappropriated lands within the state to be selected and located in legal subdivisions as provided in Section 6 of this Act shall be and hereby granted to the, in other words, the federal government is granting them their property to them. Do you see what they're doing? They have basically laid it out that they have full control over every state. I have seen lawyers that aren't employed by the federal government, but they've been educated by the bar. They truly believe that the federal government owns anything and everything within the United States unabashed. I mean, there's no constraints. That Constitution has been so redefined and so perverted by the annotated Constitution that there can be no barriers or boundaries at all for the federal government. Folks, this is where we are. This is why we go through the ratification debates. These are the legal terms and definitions of how that Constitution must be. And the only way to change any of these terms, definitions, stipulations that are within the ratification debates is via an amendment. A justice does not have the authority to redefine anything that was defined in the ratification debates. Those are considered locked, solidified, and galvanized to the Constitution. In contract law, when one is making the negotiations and actually laying out stipulations and or terms and definitions, those are literally ingrained. They're, like I said, galvanized to the Constitution. This is the one time in contract law where the contract itself is still soft putty, soft clay, where you can actually make these adjoinments as you start helping people understand what those things mean. The Federalist Papers, nothing. They're just insightful, but they have done more harm because everybody saw that Alexander Hamilton implied these concepts of interpretation, concepts that the Supreme Court, the federal court, had more powers granted to them via the Federalist Papers than anything that was ever described during the ratification debates. This is how the federal government broke through, by using the courts to break through the Constitution and to start assuming anything and everything under the sun. Folks, the process is easy. All the states have to do is assume their rightful authority over that Constitution and lay it out that the federal government only has jurisdiction over those things arising under that Constitution. If it hasn't been amended, they can't hear it. They cannot drag you into that court. If we actually have the people, if we actually have our... And so this is why lawyers can't be trusted. Because a lawyer, if you actually hire a lawyer, they can undermine you. So who is it that we have to focus on? What is it that will actually take this legal system and turn it into liquid where it'll just basically seep into the cracks and go away. All of these laws, these statutes, all of the color of law, all of the fabrications that have been unconstitutionally created, how does that happen? Well, it's easy. What type of government do we have? Do we have a judiciary form of government? No. We don't even have an executive form of government. We have a Republican form of government, and our Constitution grants only our representative bodies with very specific powers. And therefore, they can't meddle with anything that's not within their power. Therefore, when the states actually lay out and say, you've created these things, the only way you can get rid of the Department of Education, the only way it can be gotten rid of legitimately, is for the states to tell the federal government, you have no authority to be exercising that role, responsibility, power, property, what have you. That is not delegated to you. Therefore, you have violated the Constitution by, one, creating that, spending all the money that you're doing and everything that you're doing involving that. Therefore, you will shut that down and you will, you know, inform the world that you overstepped your bounds, that you actually assumed powers not granted, and that everybody in the Department of Education will be set to be laid off over the course of the next 6 months. Those who are least valuable to the transition of the, you know, the basically turning the lights off and dispositioning all properties, all things to the states, then those things, you know, those people will be laid off. Those people that would be considered valuable for ensuring the transition, and the states will actually need to send people in. The states will actually need to have some form of oversight so that the records do not get deleted or destroyed. Because down the road, we need to have all of the documentation to actually start holding everybody accountable. Because if you want to fix the problem, you don't just fix the problem. You have to prove that people who violate the people's trust, people who are actually committing insurrections against the Constitution, be fully prosecuted at the full extent of the law, which means that there's going to be some people, folks, that are going to be hanged, because the Constitution calls for being hanged. It doesn't call for lethal injection. It doesn't call for, you know, guns. It requires public hanging. You want to change the form of execution for somebody that has been found guilty, then, and there's no such thing as life imprisonment. If you commit treason, you're found guilty, you will be hanged, and that's it. So, Section 8, the lands of the extent of two townships in quantity authorized by the third section of the Act, February 21, 855, to be reserved for the establishment of the University of Utah. They're actually laying out this, that you can have a university, when that's up to the state to decide whether it's going to have a university or whether they want to call it an academic center. Whatever they want to call it is up to the state. That the federal government is basically saying you're going to have a university here and you're going to have a university there. No, you don't have that authority, federal government. And so as we go through this, said lands that may not have been selected by said territory may be selected by said state. That in addition to, may be selected by the said state. That in addition to the above 110,000 acres of land to be selected and located as provided in the foregoing section of this act and including all the saline lands, in other words, Salt Lake, in said state are hereby granted to the state for the use of the said university. Are you kidding me? Locking down land for this university? Why were they doing this? Because they knew by this point in time, folks, where was the communist movement moving in America? Where was its foothold? And where was it growing and infiltrating the United States? It was in academia. the first places that the Fabian societies came in and penetrated and permeated themselves in all of the top-level schools across America. By this point in time, they were already moving into what was UC Berkeley. They were already moving into the primary universities, ensuring that everybody was learning these Marxist economic standards, these Marxist ideals, so that everybody would no longer be taught America's true history and the truth about the Constitution. So I'm going to jump into Section 9. The 5% of the proceeds of the sales of public land lying within said state, which shall be sold by the United States. In other words, the United States, not the state, they're going to sell the land to the admission of the said state after deducting all expenses incident to the same. In other words, they're going to charge you. The federal government is going to charge the state when they sell these lands that the state has to sell, that the federal government's not giving up their land. And so when they sell these lands, it will be placed into a permanent fund with the interest, and basically it is to support the common schools. In other words, they're creating a financial process of how the state was going to fund their little, I'll just say, indoctrination centers to start helping everybody learn the perversion of America so that they will all, you know, move forward in lockstep towards the communist globalist cause. Now, the interesting thing is, it's been a century and a quarter, a little over a century and a quarter since this time, and they still haven't been able to seal the deal. They still have not been able to push us off the cliff. We have time, folks, but we're running out of time. It's now or never. We have to take a stand and say, you had no authority to do these things. You have no authority to do those things. You have so little authority. Why is it that you're doing all of the things that you do? And that goes for your state governments too, folks. Your state governments need to be woken up to say, you can't be doing these things. We never authorized. The only states where they were so progressive that they actually amended their constitution to do those things, the only way to save those states truly is going through the full process of merging, or I should say, because every state needs to create county constitutions. But that will be the purging process of these states that have really gone overboard in using democracy to actually destroy the Republican form of government that they have and created these bastions of communism and unconstitutional government. Section 10, that the proceeds of lands herein granted for educational purposes, except as hereinafter otherwise provided, shall constitute a permanent school fund, the interest of which only shall be expended for the support of said schools. In other words, the communists were making sure that they were protecting and making sure that nobody could come in and touch these things, that they were going to make sure that the good people of Utah were getting a good indoctrination into what they needed to learn. Section 11, the schools, colleges, and universities provided for in this act shall forever remain under the exclusive control of the state, and no part of the proceeds arising from the sale or dispersal of lands herein granted for educational purposes or of the income thereof shall be used for the support of any sect. So this is where they wanted to make sure that they kept Mormonism out of their schools. This is where they, so folks, as much as many people thought this was a great thing, when they can start affecting the religion of one sect, of one doctrine, eventually they will step into, you know, the center of all religions and affect all. And in 1920, with the Scopes trial, that's exactly what they did. They basically said, we will not teach the Bible at all. You give up land, you let the camel's nose in the tent when they have no authority to be involved in religion at all. How is this right here not a law respecting religion and the free exercise thereof? Section 12, that in lieu of the grant of land for purposes of internal improvement made to new states by the 8th section of the Act of September 4th, 1841. So this right here is, to me, This is where you go and find where the federal government permanently created this authority. It was, they did this before the Civil War. They did this after Madison had been buried. You understand what I just said? The last of the framers who really knew what was going on, this is when the federal government really started going nuts and crazy, because there was nobody out there that had any true understanding to challenge them. Because everybody, this is when illiteracy was rampant. And this is where they started teaching the new doctrines of the Constitution, this concept of a living Constitution. The only reason that we've been able to actually get back to understanding the Constitution, folks, is not because of the Federalist Papers. It is what's the way of saying it is not the it is not because of them. It is actually, there's a word for it, and it's eluding me. But the reality is, the truth is only in the ratification debates. The truth is not in the Federalist Papers, which is why Hamilton and his little protégés out there, the lawyers and those people, used and made sure that the Federalist Papers became the standard. Now, I've got a little excerpt that I want to share with you that actually should actually scare the crap out of you, but I've got it right. Let me see here. The First Amendment, there we go. And so when somebody goes to this link, if you go and search this one thing, you will find AI out of Google will actually tell you. So let me tell you what the search string is. The only source documents to understand the Constitution. If you folks go type this, if you type this and you notice that there's this overview that AI generates for you, because what we're asking is, what are the only source documents that we have to understand the Constitution? Everybody listening to the show knows the real answer is the ratification debates. We proved this. Madison even proves this and demands it. So this is exactly what they said. Here's the overview. To truly understand the U.S. Constitution, several key primary source documents are essential. The Constitution itself, the Federalist Papers, and the Supreme Court decisions. The Constitution is a foundational document outlining the structure of government and the rights of the citizens. No. It outlines the limits of the government, their roles, their responsibilities, their powers, the few properties they can possess. But the way they go through this, they are completely oblivious of this. Folks, how you redefine the Constitution is how you subvert it. So going on, it says the Federalist Papers provide insights into the founders' intentions and arguments for ratification. They mention the word ratification, but they dare not point to the ratification debates. While the Supreme Court decisions interpret and apply the Constitution over time, shaping its meaning, reshaping its definitions, reshaping, re-envisioning our government, reimagining our government. That's what the Supreme Court has been doing for a couple of centuries. Here's the detailed breakdown. One, the Constitution is the primary document. This is the primary source document outlining the structure and powers of the federal government, as well as the rights and responsibilities of the citizen. It consists of 7 articles ratified in 1788 and has been amended 27 times. Actually, it's been amended 28 times. And actually, when you look at the federal Constitution itself, I have challenged, there was a gentleman in Oregon who creates this class, and he's becoming pretty popular. I think his last name's Chambers. But he created his own class a long, long time ago, and he teaches the Constitution. And I challenged his what he teaches. And he actually, I talked to him. I interviewed him way back in, I think, 2017, 2018. I think it was 2016 or 2017. And I could go find it, because I can actually pinpoint the point in time, because I've got emails back and forth with him. But I actually challenged him both in person or on phone and on air in an interview. that what he was asserting, based on the common understanding of what they read in the Constitution, was absolutely wrong. And he wasn't too happy, because he had done, this was a life work for him. It's the same thing with Hillsdale College. It's the same thing with any edification, or I should say edifice, I'm sorry. Let me slow down here. It is the same with any university or edifice that teaches the Constitution, how by using the Constitution, the Supreme Court, and the Federalist Papers, you will be wrong. It's that simple. The only way to be right on what is constitutional, what that Constitution means, is the ratification debates. Now, there are other things that actually help clarify, because if it wasn't brought up in the ratification debates, the first go-to document should be Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. That's where we found the equal footing doctrine actually evolve and how it was argued between the framers. Now, as we look at other things to understand, like citizenship, when the U.S. Congress started creating a uniform act of naturalization, they were very clear in how they defined that. The only way you can legitimately define that, again, as the states basically say, we agree, if they start changing it to actually really pervert it, where it means 180 from what it was, that is not legitimate. Congress can't just redefine it because the whims demanded it. It would require the states to actually, and when they do this, the states must step in and get in their grill and go, you are actually redefining something. You don't have the authority to make those types of changes, folks. As we go through these documents, and let me finish going through this AI output, we're proving to you how all of these conservative organizations have been misleading you, because they believe the same thing, and AI has embraced these perversions that these people have created. And it all goes back to Marshall and the lawyers that really recreated and reimagined our legal system into civil law instead of states having common law. And basically changing a legal system where the federal government was involved in every aspect of our lives. Two, the second document, the Federalist Papers, these essays written by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay, were published in the New York papers in 1787 and 1788 to persuade citizens to ratify the Constitution. Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, to be clear, this was New York. Again, it says New York here. It doesn't say in all of the states. And most of these documents, like I said, especially the judiciary, those were all written after the Constitution was fully ratified, or after at least 50% of the ratification requirements. So as we go through the second part, they offer valuable insights to the founders' understandings of the Constitution and its intended meaning. Yeah, they have insights, that's all, nothing legal. They can be assessed or accessed through the Library of Congress and other online sources. Three, the Supreme Court decisions. The Supreme Court's interpretations of the Constitution through legal precedent, none of these, interpretation or legal precedents, are crucial. They're saying are crucial. These things are not legitimate, folks. The Supreme Court can only make decisions based on law and fact. No interpretation, not using precedents. So I apologize for ranting and getting derailed. We'll be back, and there are certain things we're going to have to go back through again, because you need to understand the importance of the Tory Acts and some of these documents, because people are starting to wake up, and we're here to help, and we're not from the government. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.